Hello, everyone. Forgive me if I'm talking a little less passionately sounding than usual. I'm still getting over a bit of sickness. Hopefully my nose should be a little less runny and the coughs aren't quite as bad. My last video, I sounded quite sick, but I have stuff I want to talk about, and I'm not going to let my illness keep me from doing it. So in this video, I wanted to talk a bit about the tradition of Abrahamic religion in a different perspective. I suppose I want to make this video as a kind of olive branch of sorts to those in monotheistic traditions, especially the Judeo-Christian ones. But I don't want to misrepresent myself. I am in the anti-monotheistic camp. I think that polytheism is a truer, purer, more perfect form of spirituality. And I think that the domineering and intolerant nature of traditional monotheism has destroyed a ton of the diversity and richness of spiritual life around the world. As I said in another video, if biodiversity is the recognition of the inherent worth of a manifold of richness and variety in species in the natural world, then my purpose in life is to honor theodiversity, the inherent worth of a manifold of richness and variety of gods in the spiritual world. So I care so much about this because it seems like the one thing that's hardest to change. A lot of things that are negative about Christianity, like suppression of science, or hatred and fear over sexuality, or whatever else I've complained about, which, believe me, I have good reasons to, but those are things that seem to change as the world becomes more modern, and seem to be changing almost as a matter of necessity. But what does not seem to be passing away is the way that so much of the world thinks in singular rather than plural terms when it comes to anything spiritual. This tendency to try to sum up all spirituality as a monad, as a single oneness, and so on, seems so deeply embedded. For some people, that kind of mashing together of everything into a oneness might seem transcendent and beautiful, but to me, suppressing all the multiple gods into aspects of some oneness feels kind of more like when you scribble a bunch of crayons together until all the colors become an indistinct brown. So that's why theodiversity is my calling. But even if we move in that direction in the Western world, we're going to have to subsume and appropriate the Judeo-Christian tradition in one way or another. We have to stand in some relation to it, even if our attitude is fundamentally opposed to it. It's just like the Christians had to stand in some way or other in relation to the polytheistic Greco-Roman world before them. So what do I think we should do? I think we should absorb Jehovah as one God among others. We should see churches and mosques and synagogues as shrines to Jehovah, one God among others. I would like to think that those who are interested in comparative religion like me are all to some degree already polytheist in spirit, whether we want to admit it or not. So today, I want to talk a little bit about what I think is valuable and worth preserving from the tradition of Jehovah, because believe it or not, I do think that there are such things. For one thing, I should offer sympathy first of all to the Christians above all others, because the first theodiversity to fall victim to the oppression of orthodoxy and monotheistic religions was that within Christianity itself. If you read the innumerable number of books that could have become part of the Christian canon but were rejected and considered heretical and considered apocryphal and non-canonical gospels and whatnot, you can't help but imagine the strange, interesting kinds of Christianity that might have developed as a result of them, not to mention other syncretic movements like Manichaeism. And all of these were crushed and suppressed, often with even greater vigor than so-called pagan religions. So, I've read the Bible from cover to cover. Even if you only view it as a historical document, it's too important to ignore. In fact, sometimes I still go back to it for spiritual sustenance, as hard as that might be to believe for some of you. Even though I'd no way consider myself a Christian. Arthur Schopenhauer once called the Christian religion a strange centaur because it attempts to unite two worldviews that he says are fundamentally opposed in its Old and New Testaments. He promotes an interesting theory, which is that the fundamental opposition between religions is not whether they are polytheistic or monotheistic, but whether they are optimistic or pessimistic. He says that the Old Testament is a fundamentally optimistic text and represents Judaism, which is an optimistic worldview. It describes the Israelites as the chosen people of a God who will protect them. The rewards they receive are of the world, safety, land, riches, food, and so on. It says that God made the world and was very pleased with everything in it. That is not to say that the Old Testament is always happy. There's an entire book in it called Lamentations, and the mood of much of the poetry and song of the Old Testament of Islam is of lamentation and grief. The history of the Israelites was certainly full of sorrow and hardship. And yet, its worldview rests on the assumption that happiness is to be found in the world, and that we should be devoted to and motivated by what is good in the world. All of this, Schopenhauer claims, is in contrast to the teachings of Christ and are the core of the New Testament. He claims that in this sense, the New Testament is far closer to Buddhism or Hinduism in its ultimate spiritual message, even if it is monotheistic in contrast to them. He, in fact, believed that there was some Indian origin, probably, to the teachings of the New Testament, and we don't exactly know. It could be. But he says that in its real value and message, it's closer to those Indian religions, even though it's monotheistic, unlike them. That's because he says that its ultimate message, like Buddhism and Hinduism, recognizes and takes seriously the fact that the world is full of suffering. The New Testament, unlike the Old, teaches not to turn towards the world. The New Testament teaches not to turn towards the world in all its ugliness and suffering, and yet to find beauty and meaning within it, like the Old Testament teaches, but teaches to overcome it and turn away from it through asceticism and renunciation and pessimism, believing that the world is corrupt and base. For him, the Christian religion has never been able to reach the spiritual heights of the Indian religions because it is saddled with an Old Testament that keeps it from being as pessimistic and therefore insightful as its real teaching should entail. I think that there's a lot that's true about this view. I would say that perhaps the book of Ecclesiastes is the book in the Old Testament that comes the closest to capturing this quote-unquote New Testament view of the world, you know, vanity, vanity, all is vanity, nothing is new under the sun. And that's perhaps why it's my favorite book in the Bible, Ecclesiastes. That is, unless I'm feeling like trolling people, and I say it's the Song of Solomon, because that's the one with all the sex that the Christians ignore. Haha. So, I agree that there is such a shift here that I think Christianity is a religion at odds with itself. The Old Testament honors a people, a nation, and all the riches of the world. And I don't mean riches just as in terms of money, but the joys of the world, the rewards of the world, worldly things. And for that reason, it's actually closer in character to the surrounding polytheistic so-called pagan civilizations, like the Egyptians, Greeks, and Babylonians. The New Testament puts in clear terms the vanity of peoples, rejects concepts of nation, and says that the world is corrupted and full of evil and sin, and for that reason is actually closer in character, Schopenhauer says, to the Indian religions, because it sees the highest good as a separation and resignation from things that are worldly. For this reason, I think that a purer form of Christianity would actually separate itself more and more from the Old Testament and probably follow a Gnostic path, maybe even casting the God of the Old Testament as a demiurge, an evil figure. But as for what I think is valuable and worth preserving in all this, because I haven't really gotten to that yet, it's the teachings of the man Jesus of Nazareth. I think the quote from Mahatma Gandhi was, "I like your Christ, I do not like your Christians. Your Christians are so unlike your Christ." I'm certainly not the first to point out the differences between the messages that the historical Christ seemed to preach and the perverse interpretations of them that have gone on for centuries. And I think, in a way, that's the way the Gospels are to read. That's why. They're so simple and straightforwardly written, but also laden with strange little turns of phrase and odd snatches of seeming historical realism that I think anyone who reads them, at least in my experience, somehow feels like they're discovering the real teaching for the first time that no one else ever has. Like, somehow every time you read them, it feels like you're being reacquainted fresh with the teaching, which is a pretty incredible effect to have for what are probably the most closely studied texts in all of human history. But I guess most religious texts can be like that to an extent. Certainly I feel that way to a degree when reading like the Tao Te Ching or the Buddhist Sutras, but I think it's that weird bit of historicism and kind of almost unpolished, rustic kind of character of the Gospels that add so much. And what are those teachings of Christ you come to for the first time when you see them in their stark clarity that have been so obscured? It makes sense why they're obscure when you realize what they are, because they're pretty radical teachings. They're teachings that seek to eliminate unjust hierarchies that society sustains itself by. To put it bluntly, Jesus was an anarchist. It's hilarious to me that there's a whole movement of so-called Christian nationalism in the United States especially, because that term's the greatest oxymoron I've ever heard. As Paul says in Galatians 3:28, there is neither Jew nor Greek, there's neither bond nor free, there's neither male nor female, for ye are all one in Christ Jesus. In fact, one of the many reasons that Christianity was such a terrifying social movement to the early Roman Empire is that, unlike Judaism, it had no respect for the state or nation. It was rightfully understood as a system of thought that abolished any and all hierarchies. So, of course, they had to appropriate it and wield it as a tool of power and oppression to separate it from those original teachings. No one, I think, understood Christianity better than Leo Tolstoy, the primary influence on Mahatma Gandhi, who more famously distinguished between Christ and Christians, and really rephrased a lot of the stuff Tolstoy said, of course, with a Hindu perspective. In The Kingdom of God Is Within You, a book, Tolstoy makes a point that I really love. He says that the teachings of Christ made their appearance and spread so widely because they were so obvious to all. Love thy neighbor as thyself, love your enemies, turn the other cheek, bless those who curse you, give up your worldly things, and live in poverty, which is really spiritual wealth. Tolstoy says that Christ was already misunderstood during the time the Bible was written, because when the Bible was written, it became full of all these attestations of miracles and superhuman things that Jesus and his disciples did. But Tolstoy says no one needs a miracle to prove to them that you should love thy neighbor. We all know the truth of that as soon as we hear it, because it feels right. We know it's right. It's intuitively right. We might not want to admit it. We might see inside ourselves and see that we don't live up to it, but it's right. We know it is. We don't need a proof. And as he says, it becomes more and more arcane and difficult to explain why exactly a tongue of fire appearing over an apostle's head somehow proves that what he said is going to be the absolute truth. For Tolstoy, then, all attempts to set up an organized church to dictate what is heresy or orthodoxy is not only misguided, but fundamentally opposed to the spirit and message of Christ. I have to quote him at length because he's such a great writer. Quote, "Heresy makes its appearance in the church. It is the effort to break through the petrified authority of the church. All effort after a living comprehension of the doctrine has been made by heretics. Tertullian, Origen, Augustine, Luther, Hus, Savonarola, Helchitsky, and the rest were heretics. It could not be otherwise. The follower of Christ, whose service means an ever-growing understanding of his teaching and an ever-closer fulfillment of progress toward perfection, cannot, just because he is a follower of Christ, claim for himself or any other that he understands Christ's teaching fully and fulfills it. Still less can he claim this for any body of men." Unquote. And again, quote, "The churches as churches are not, as many people suppose, institutions which have Christian principles for their basis, even though they may have strayed little away from the straight path. The churches, as bodies which assert their own infallibility, are institutions opposed to Christianity. There is not only nothing in common between the churches as such and Christianity except the name, but they represent two principles fundamentally opposed and antagonistic to one another. One represents pride, violence, self-assertion, stagnation, and death. The other, meekness, penitence, humility, progress, and life. We cannot serve these two masters. We have to choose between them." Unquote. Now, I do want to be clear and nuanced about what I'm saying here, though. A lot of people are familiar with the idea of separating the historical figure of Jesus from the mythological figure that's been built up over thousands of years. But I do think that it's dishonest to basically paint Jesus as a secular hippie who didn't talk about anything but loving your neighbor. Because Jesus was a spiritual leader, and his message was spiritual at the end of the day. And quite profoundly spiritual. Of course, it seems that over the course of the Gospels, the spiritual and airy side was continually emphasized over the more earthy and ethical teaching. If you read the Gospel generally agreed to be the latest, John, and compare it to the earliest, Mark, the difference is stark in how much more magical and airy John is than Mark. There isn't even a resurrection in Mark. There's nothing that implies that Jesus came back to life after death, unless you read the weird extra version that was added to that's obviously ahistorical. Of course, there's much of importance in these spiritual teachings of Christ, I think. One of my all-time favorite quotes about religion is in John 3:8, where Christ says, quote, "The wind bloweth where it listeth, and thou hearest the sound thereof, but canst not tell whence it cometh and whither it goeth. So is everyone that is born of the Spirit," unquote. These words could have come from the Tao Te Ching. Rarely have I seen such a simple and yet more profound statement of what it means to feel the grand mystery and sublimity of the world and come into contact with something spiritual. And yet, what I do want to make clear is that Jesus' radical, anarchic, pacifistic teachings always had a spiritual basis. It was the world he was in. I think there's quite a similar case to be made for the Buddha. A lot of people try to talk about the core teachings of Buddhism as being something not mystical, but a very practical, empirical, self-help teaching of sort about how to free ourselves from suffering by cutting off desire, living simply, and not doing violence to others. However, even if we can theoretically call this the core of Buddhism, Rupert Gethin makes a point in his book, The Foundations of Buddhism, highly recommended if anyone wants a little bit higher level introduction to Buddhism that's more than the super basics. Anyway, the point he makes is that even if we could theoretically imagine this kind of foundational core of Buddhism that doesn't believe in reincarnation or karma and is just talking about like the empirical self-help side of it, or their ideas of karma and everything are very scientifically based and realized, we could imagine that, but that's never how Buddhism has existed in history. It certainly is not how the Buddha taught it. Even in the oldest sutras we have, the Buddha is already using religious metaphors and imagery of the Hindu gods that already existed around him. He's using the language of the Hindu spiritual tradition he's a part of. He already takes the Hindu pantheon as a given, at least as a language of symbolism, and thus of meaning. And indeed, Buddhism has basically done this in all the countries it became the major religion of. China, Japan, and Korea all became Buddhist, while accommodating and coexisting with indigenous systems of worship and philosophies, and indeed appropriating them to use as a method of teaching. Sometimes more peacefully than other times. So while you could perhaps create a secular vision of Buddhist teachings, and there's certainly value in doing so, it's not coming into contact with the real Buddhism. The real Buddhism is meant to exist behind and augment whatever vision of the world you already have, not create a new one, and do so in a spiritual way. And I think Jesus' teachings were probably very similar. He taught these messages, but in a Jewish milieu with a monotheistic spiritual language. And that is what I'd like to see Christianity evolve more into. A system that sits behind and augments the indigenous systems of religion that already exist. And of course does so about the good teachings of nonviolence and loving one's neighbor and living simply. Not the ones that hate sex and hate fun and hate anything good in the world. In fact, I see no reason why Christ's most poignant and important teachings, the ones I mentioned, couldn't even be adapted to a polytheistic society, in the same way that the Buddha's no less spiritually driven teachings have been in many modern secular nations. In fact, I think we were probably on the route to that happening with the Gnostic development of Christianity, would have been more influenced by Neoplatonism, maybe even Manichaeism would have brought it into contact with Buddhism, and something awesome would have been born, but can't change the past. So that's what I'd like to honor and in a way appropriate from the Judeo-Christian tradition, because we all have to relate to it in some way in the West, even if we do what I wish we would and all move into a glorious era of polytheistic neo-paganism. My ancestors! Okay. Anyway, thank you for listening. Sorry I'm still a bit sick. See you later. Bye.